If I can take my coffee break, my coffee break, my coffee break. If I can take my coffee break, something within me dies.
Caffeine is necessary to start the day.
It's soothing at the same time that it. I know it's going to perk me up before I start my day.
One or two in the morning, maybe another one in the middle of the morning, a couple more noon, and a couple of dinner, and maybe some later.
I really don't drink that much coffee. Sure, I have a cup or two to wake up. Who doesn't? Well, maybe a cup or three. Then I have one at the gym just before exercising. Maybe two or three. Then I head to the office, where I keep a cup nearby to train my energies in reading, writing, returning phone calls. Then lunch. I mean, lots of people have a fresh cup of coffee with lunch. After all, who doesn't? Well, after lunch, there's more work, so, more coffee. Now, even I don't have coffee with dinner. Its vibrant and assertive taste can quite overwhelm more timid flavors. But there is something about a cup of coffee after dinner that brings closure, a sense of quietude. Now, all this coffee doesn't trouble my sleep. I'm not off without any kind of problem whatsoever. 2, 3 in the morning, I'm out like a light. Then, of course, I'm up at 5 to feed the cat. She's got her fish-flavored crunchies. I have a cup of coffee, just to get started. It's not a problem, really. Now, many of my friends and colleagues think I have some kind of problem with coffee. I only have a problem when I don't have enough coffee. I mean, in places without coffee, like Kosovo, I was sprinkling little tiny coffee crystals on my tongue. Clearly, someone who will sprinkle the worst form of coffee ever devised is after something else, and that's caffeine.
So let's have another cup of coffee.
Let's have another piece of pie.
Bennett Allen Weinberg and Bonnie K. Beeler have brewed, if you please, a whole steaming cultural history of caffeine that spans the distance between oolong and double half-calf no-foam lattes. Their book is called The World of Caffeine, the Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug. Bennett Weinberg joins us now from Philadelphia. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
And without getting carried away, we are talking about a drug, aren't we?
Well, caffeine is a drug in every sense of the word. The word drug is used in different ways. It can be used to refer to something that affects your system physically. Mm-hmm. It can be something that affects your mind. It can be something that's addictive. Caffeine is a drug in all of these senses. It is an addictive, psychoactive substance that has profound effects on the mind and body.
You can almost take a look at a timeline of history and see where caffeine kicks in, can't you?
Yes, you can. Coffee especially appears very suddenly and rather mysteriously in the Yemen and southern Arabia around the year 1500. And within 100 years, it had taken over the Arab world. And within another 100 years, it had just about taken over the whole world.
Mm-hmm. You make a point of saying that the rise of caffeinated beverages can be seen in response to the rise of chronological timekeeping.
Before the advent of the caffeinated botanicals and the beverages made from them in the 17th century in Europe, people were two-fisted drinkers, and they loved their beer. And in fact, they didn't have safe water to drink, and poor people got a great deal of their nutrition from beer. So they'd have beer soup in the morning, and they'd drink from morning till evening. Yeah. Well, if you can imagine a society in which people were pretty much chronically drunk, you could see that that isn't one that fits well into the picture of the industrial economy that we have today. And when the demands for regulating work schedules, for working longer hours, for organizing people in large groups who could work at a regular schedule became really serious, that was a time in which they needed a good clock and which they needed somehow to escape from their previous habits that were deleterious to productivity.
You have a section in your book where you talk about, what amounts to Balzac's paean to the creative powers of caffeine, don't you?
Yes, indeed. He was one of the most prolific novelists in history. It turns out that he was a maniacal coffee addict, and really a caffeine addict, of course. And he began by drinking fairly strong coffee, and he kept increasing the amount he would drink on a daily basis, till finally he ended up eating coffee grounds to get more caffeine. And he used to lock himself in his room, a very poor man, and stay up all night writing every night and dosing himself with increasing doses of caffeine. He died in his early 40s. His doctor
I'm almost not surprised.
Well, you're right. I mean, talk about burning yourself out. This is an extreme case. But yeah. He did speak about the benefits benefits of caffeine for the creative process. I can read you a brief passage
Please.
To that effect.
Yeah.
He writes, "After taking coffee, ideas quick march into motion like battalions of a grand army to its legendary fighting ground, and the battle rages. Memories charge in, bright flags on high. The cavalry of metaphor deploys with a magnificent gallop. The artillery of logic rushes up with clattering wagons and cartridges. When imagination's orders, sharpshooters sight and fire, forms and shapes and characters rear up. The paper is spread with ink, for the nightly labor begins and ends with torrents of this black water."
Wow.
Well, there's a man in love.
Yes, exactly.
Are you slurping coffee, Mr. Weinberg?
I wish I were. I couldn't get any. I'm depending on a glass of water right now.
Oh, right. Well, we'll...
Yes, which is really no substitute.
We'll get you out soon. But you also write that the British Coffee House might have been responsible for helping to devise a new aspect of narrative in Western literature.
People seem to come together in the coffee houses, and all kinds of people. We're talking about merchants, soldiers, diplomats, students, scientists, writers, and they cultivated the art of conversation there, which really was something that, in a way, had been neglected in England in terms of written style. And men like Defoe and Addison and Steele began writing, and they often published their works in the coffee houses. And they based their works largely on the conversations that went on in the coffee houses. And from the mixing and mingling of the coffee house and the conversation that went on in the coffee house, a new style seemed to emerge, which took advantage of the natural power of conversation to convey and persuade. So this really did kick off a new era in English letters.
You've got a section in your book that intrigues me about you volunteer a list of some of the differences between the coffee culture and the tea culture.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if we can go back and forth together on that a little bit, sort
yes,
of a
sure.
responsive reading. Do you want to be coffee or tea?
I'll be coffee.
Okay, I'll be tea. Okay, begin.
Male.
Female.
Boisterous.
Decorous.
Bohemian.
Conventional.
Obvious.
Subtle.
Common.
Refined.
Vice.
Virtue.
Excess.
Moderation.
Passion or earthiness.
Spirituality. Mysticism. I think we get the idea.
Where
did all this come from, do you think?
We just found it by examining the extensive cultures associated with coffee and tea throughout the world. As to what causes this duality, that's more mysterious. The same caffeine is found in coffee as is in tea. It's true that tea, as it's normally prepared, contains less caffeine, somewhat less, but since you usually have several cups of either beverage, you can certainly get a full dose from either. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that in the Far East, for example, you really do find caffeine in the medium of tea in the tea ceremony associated with spirituality, with tranquility, with refinement, with decorousness, with balance. You also find this, for example, in the English afternoon tea. And then, of course, you find coffee associated with just all the opposite things.
How bad is it for you?
Caffeine in a normal, healthy adult does not seem to be associated with any sort of physical pathology. Mm-hmm. I think there are more serious concerns, however, in health, and they relate to pregnancy. It's been demonstrated that caffeine intake during pregnancy increases dramatically the chances of miscarriage. So this is really something to keep in mind.
Another question we're sort of curious about. Do you infer any particular significance between the fact that Seattle, which we identify in North America as the progenitor of a whole coffee movement, is also the home of Microsoft?
Well, perhaps the need for caffeinated beverages. You know, I mentioned that caffeine seems to have been instrumental in the rise of modern industrial society. And of course, everyone knows that we've been undergoing another revolution in the last 20 years and that we're still in the middle of, the successor to the Industrial Revolution, the Computer Revolution. And I think this is one in which caffeine is playing perhaps even a greater role than it did in the Industrial Revolution. There isn't a computer company in the world that doesn't have Coke machines and coffee machines readily available. They supply it free to their people. Now, this isn't just because coffee can help wake you up and therefore may help you to work a little longer. It aids in hand-eye coordination, so you can key things in more accurately. Maybe more important, it also increases verbal fluency, it increases memory, it increases the ability to do calculations more accurately, and it may stimulate creative thought, too. So the fact is, this has become the drug of the computer world.
Mr. Weinberg, thank you very much.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Bennett Weinberg, medical science writer, is the co-author, along with Bonnie K. Beeler, of The World of Caffeine, speaking with us from the studios of member station WHYY in Philadelphia.